This program is brought to you by RTS on iTunes U at the virtual campus of Reformed Theological Seminary. To listen to other courses or to access other materials from RTS, please visit us at itunes.rts.edu. For information on how you may obtain a fully accredited Master of Arts in Religion degree online, please visit us at virtual.rts.edu.
Called the Amarna period. The capital, the area that Akhenaten built, is given the name by archaeologist Tel El Amarna. And so this particular period is called the Amarna period. Now, this new cult did not really have widespread following, but it produced enough disruption in Egypt that Egypt was so focused on internal concerns that they were not able to deal with problems going on in the land of Canaan, where they sort of had oversight and controlled that area. In fact, we have letters, Amarna letters, from the land of Canaan calling for help from Egypt. Let me read to you a brief paragraph. This is from ISBE, I-S-B-E, the old ISBE, I think, 1979. It says, most of the Amarna letters reveal an unsettled state of affairs in Syro-Palestine. The morale of the Canaanite princelings had greatly deteriorated during the period of Egyptian decline, with the result that they were often at war with each other. In their correspondence, they occasionally stooped to hurling mutual accusations of treason against the crown and disloyalty toward one another. Under such circumstances, they were vulnerable to attack by dissident elements within their own domains, as well as by enemies from without. And in their letters to the pharaohs, we frequently read their desperate pleas for fresh supplies of Egyptian and Nubian archers to man their garrisons. Such requests were met uniformly with a stony silence by the Egyptian court, and because they were preoccupied with domestic concerns. Now, the Amarna letters also mention a group called the Habiru. Which could be confused with the Hebrews, but the term Habiru and the term Hebrew should not be seen to be equal to each other. People may have thought Hebrews and Habirus were closely related, people in the land of Canaan, but the term Habiru has a much broader connotation of mercenaries. Many of them were mercenaries who sold their services to the highest bidders in terms of a fighting force. They tended to be marginal, disenfranchised people. But one of your questions from Joshua will be related to the model of the conquest. We're not going to get into that question in class, but you'll put together a short answer coming out of the chapter on Joshua of the different models of the conquest. The Bible represents the conquest as Israel invading the land of Canaan from outside. Others have tried to develop other models, a revolt model, peasant revolt model, and some of those might sort of pick up on this whole Habiru thing and try to substantiate their views. There was also, during this period, a resurgence of the Hittite power, and so the kingdom of Mitanni had to deal with the Hittites, and in fact, the kingdom of Mitanni was defeated by the Hittites. And so it's very interesting in God's providence. The very time when Israel is taking the land of Canaan, Egypt is unable to respond because of what's going on internally. And the kingdom of Mitanni is preoccupied with the Hittites, which sort of leaves the door open. God in his providence, you know, opening the door that his people can go in and take the land of Canaan and not have to worry about the Egyptians coming up and causing problems, if you will. Now, we come to the book of Joshua. Joshua is directly connected to Deuteronomy in several ways, and I list several themes that show this connection. The theme of holy war. The principles laid out in Deuteronomy are now implemented in the book of Joshua. The land and its distribution. The promise of Abraham of a land is now about to be fulfilled. And the land is distributed in the book of Joshua after it is taken. The role of Joshua parallels Moses in many ways. You can imagine losing a leader like Moses. You know, nobody wants to be the pastor in a church after, you know, somebody well-known and has been there 30 years, it's tough to do that, isn't it? And so you can imagine Joshua wondering, will the people have the same, will they follow me like they followed Moses? But there are some things that happen that reinforce that he is the one who is to lead them into the land of Canaan. You have the crossing of the Red Sea with Moses. You've got the crossing of the Jordan River with Joshua. You've got Passover celebrations in both instances with Moses and Joshua, and then you've got an incident we'll look at where Joshua takes off his shoes before someone, which parallels Moses and the burning bush. So Joshua is, it's reinforced that Joshua is the one who will take God's people into the land of Canaan. And then you have obedience to the law stressed, Joshua chapter 1:8. The book of the law shall not depart from your mouth, but you shall meditate on it day and night, to observe the duty to do according to all that is written in it. And so it's the law that we've just read about, and Moses has just given, that is to continue to be the basis of the foundation of what God's people are to do. Now, when we talk about the authorship of the book of Joshua, there's sort of several factors you have to come to grips with. There is reference in the book of Joshua to Joshua's writing activity, chapter 24, 26. So it is possible that Joshua himself may have had a hand in the book of Joshua. There's other things in the book of Joshua that reflect the antiquity of the material. And if you're interested in pursuing some of those concerns, how Joshua fits into the whole second millennium historical period, I encourage you to read the commentary by Hess in the Tyndale Commentary series. Usually the Tyndale Commentary series, because of its format, is rather brief. This is a very thick volume. It's got a lot packed into it. And one of the things that Hess focuses on is how Joshua fits into that whole second millennium context related to the description of the borders of Canaan and the Pentateuch fit, Egypt's understanding, parallels with ancient Near Eastern culture. So Hess goes into all of those things to support Joshua coming from this second millennial period. There's other evidence that points to a time close to the events. I have listed in your notes the vividness of eyewitness reports. Rahab is said to live among the Israelites to this day, which certainly pushes it closer to the events if Rahab is still alive. Yet there are other passages that indicate a later time than the events of the book. We have modern equivalents for some of the names of places given. Chapter 15:8 in Joshua is just one example of that. The deaths of Joshua is recorded. In fact, a retrospective evaluation of the elders who outlived Joshua is given. And so that would put the push the book maybe past the time of Joshua. And even events before David's time are noted. The Jebusites occupied Jerusalem. One of the things that is stated. Now, you know, what do you do with sort of this disparate information? Well, one solution is similar to what we talked about with the Pentateuch and Mosaic authorship. That the book may have come from very early on, close to the events. Maybe Joshua was the author. And then the book was given over to scribes, and they were the ones who did some of the updating and perhaps added some of the things that occur after the death of Joshua. There is a view that some are arguing that Joshua, through Kings, was produced by a single author about 550 BC using older sources. And that might be a possibility, although I lean toward the previous view. Harrison's introduction puts the book at the beginning of the monarchy. Howard's commentary in the NAC series says it's complete by David's time. And then Richard Pratt places the book a generation or two after Joshua's death in the period of the Judges. Now we come to look at the book itself. The purpose of the book is to show how God has given the land to Israel, which included rest from their enemies and fulfillment of God's promise to Abraham. The theme of the book, God's people will take possession of their inheritance if they are faithful to their covenant God. The first 12 chapters describe the conquest of the land, the military conquest of the land. And the theme of these chapters, God gives the people victory as they fight in obedience to Him. Chapters 1 through 5 describe the preparations for going into the land. And then the rest of these chapters up through chapter 12 describes the actual taking of the land of Canaan. Joshua leads the people across the Jordan River in chapter 3 when it is at flood stage, which would give the people great hope, as that parallels what Moses did in leading the people across the Red Sea. And in chapter 5, all the men of Israel undergo circumcision in preparation for taking the land. And we've already talked about how circumcision was not done during those wilderness wanderings. The emphasis in the actual conquest of the land, when we come to chapters 5:13 to chapter 12, the emphasis there is not on military strategy. Now, there is some of that. These are real military battles that Israel's army engages in, but they are not ordinary battles. What becomes very clear is it's not military preparation that's most important, but spiritual preparation. Israel is the army of God, must be trusting in Yahweh to bring her victory. And so it's not strategy, although there may be some military strategy that you come across in these chapters. That's not the emphasis, though. It's not military strategy. It's not military might. It's spiritual preparation. It's trusting in God. It's Yahweh fighting for His people. And so it doesn't mean that you're out. It doesn't matter that you're outmanned. Because God is the one who will fight for you and bring you victory. And you begin to see that as they face the formidable city of Jericho. And I don't know if you can see this very well, but you know, they're crossing the Jordan River, and they're sort of going to take this center area, sort of divide and conquer. They'll take the center area, have a covenant renewal ceremony, and then take the southern part, and then take the northern part. And so they come to Jericho. That's the first city that they encounter. And how do they take Jericho? Great military might, right? Great military strategy, right? They walk around the city once for 6 days, walk around it on the seventh day seven times, and what? Blow their trumpeters. And the walls fall down. So it's that's the paradigm. Yahweh fights for his people. In fact, as they face Jericho, at the end of chapter 5, there's an interesting incident. This is chapter 5:13. It came to pass when Joshua was by Jericho, so now this is before they take Jericho, which is in chapter 6. He lifted his eyes and looked, and behold, a man, another Ish. Remember, Jacob had a confrontation with an Ish. A man stood opposite him with his sword drawn in his hand. And Joshua went to him and said to him, "Are you for us or for our adversaries?" And he said, "No." Kind of a strange answer. "But as commander of the army of the Lord, I have now come." And Joshua fell on his face to the earth and worshipped him, and worshipped and said to him, "What does my Lord say to his servant?" And the commander of the Lord's army said to Joshua, "Take your sandals off your foot, for the place where you stand is holy." And so Joshua did. This is an Ish who is more than an Ish, as we saw with the one that Jacob wrestled with. This is the commander of the Lord's army, and he appears with his sword drawn. It's very interesting, with a drawn sword in his hand is used two times to refer to the angel of the Lord. So this is an Ish, a man, but it's more than a man. He is there as the commander of the Lord's army. And Joshua bows down and worships. And perhaps his answer in verse 14, "Are you for us or for against us?" His answer, "No," may show that his interest at this moment is not the same as Joshua's interest. That Joshua's asking the wrong question at this particular point. And when Joshua finds out who this is, he bows down and worships him. This is the commander of the army of the Lord. Joshua, Yahweh is fighting on behalf of God's people. That's the clear message. All of these battles are not just military battles. They are military battles, but they're more than military battles. It's God bringing victory for his people. And as you work your way through these chapters, you begin to see that. You see it in Jericho, because they don't take Jericho with some great display of military might or power. You see it in chapter 10, in the battle of the five kings of the Amorites, where in chapter 10, verses 12 through 15, it says, "Joshua spoke to the Lord in the day when the Lord delivered up the Amorites before the children of Israel. He said in the sight of Israel, 'Sun stand still over Gibeon, and moon in the valley of Ajalon.' And the sun stood still, and the moon stopped, till the people had revenge upon their enemies. Is this not written in the book of Jasher? So the sun stood still in the midst of heaven, and did not hasten to go down for about a whole day. And there has been no day like that before it or after it, that the Lord heeded the voice of a man. For the Lord fought for Israel." God is in control of all creation. And he uses that to help Israel defeat and pursue the Amorites. Now, there are some other suggestions that people make related to this passage of the sun standing still. Some argue that Joshua requests a bad omen. When the sun and the moon are seen at the same time on other days than the 14th of the month, it would have been considered a bad omen and very unfavorable to the Amorites. And so some argue that Joshua's requesting here a bad omen, which would throw into confusion the Amorite army. Some argue that the passage is figurative. Verses 12, part of verse 12 and 13 is poetry. And the idea here is that in a figurative way, it's represented that God fights for Israel, but we shouldn't necessarily take this literally. The parallel is given between Judges 4 and 5. You have Judges 4, the narrative, that talks about Deborah and Barak's victory, and then you have Judges 5, the song and the poetry section. And in Judges 5, you have the stars fighting on behalf of Israel. And so the idea is you've got the narrative section where it doesn't talk about that. Then you've got the poetry section that does talk about that. And so this is sort of just a figurative description of God's fighting for Israel. In fact, I believe, well, I better check on this. There's a conservative commentary that argues this. Howard in the NAC series argues this. The traditional view is that from the perspective of the earth, the sun stands still. And that God has the power, since he is the creator, and brought all this into existence, and continues to uphold the universe, that God has the power to prolong light, and from a perspective on the earth while they're fighting, for the sun to stay where it's at, to give further light so that they can continue to pursue the enemy. And what's interesting to me is, yes, you have a poetry section here, but you also have a narrative section at the end of verse 13 that goes on to say, so the sun stood still in the midst of heaven and did not hasten down. That's not poetry, that's narrative. So I'm inclined to the view that this is evidence, clear evidence, of the power of Yahweh to fight for his people and to bring victories for his people. And he will do it in magnificent ways. And so I would say the traditional view wins out. Yes, sir.
Clear sign to me of your point is God takes and waits until the whole army that are now a faithful generation crosses that river. The camp a stone's throw of Jericho. And what's God do? He incapacitates the whole army. Every Hebrew there knew the story of Levi and Simeon and Shechem. And what happens to them? Right within the walls, the side of the walls of Jericho, 627,000 foreskins in the whole army is absolutely helpless.
That's an excellent connection to make, because that occurs right there before the commander of the army appears there. Yeah. The manna also ceases at this point as well. Good point. Yes.
You know anything about the book of Jasher?
No.
Well, is there any serious effect on the Septuagint names of that?
I don't know right off the top of my head. These are ancient sources that are referred to, but some of them may have been annals that were kept related to events in history. We don't really know what they are, other than what's stated in the Bible several places. A couple of these sources are mentioned, and so what we do know is mentioned, but there's not been any evidence discovered of these sources. I'm not sure without checking why that might be, if it's a textual thing or something else going on there. Now, as long as the people carry out the instructions of God, they are victorious. And that's part of the purpose. God fights for his people when they listen to him and are obedient to him. But when there is sin in the camp, then there's problems. And you begin to see that with Achan in chapter 7. They defeat Jericho and they come up to the city of, I always call it the city of Ai, A-I. And what strikes you about this, not only do you have the fact that Achan took some of the goods under the ban, that's what he did, that was his sin, and he hid it, and nobody really knows about it. But what strikes you also about chapter 7 is Israel's a little overconfident. And there's no interaction with Yahweh here. And so in 7:3, they returned to Joshua. This is a scouting party that was sent out. They returned to Joshua and said to him, "Don't let all the people go up, but let about 2,000 or 3,000 men go up and attack Ai. Don't weary all the people there, for the people of Ai are few." Perhaps a little overconfidence. Not consulting Yahweh, and maybe if they had consulted Yahweh, it would have become clear that something was wrong that needed to be taken care of in the camp. They don't consult Yahweh. They go up to this city, not very large city, just take a few thousand people up with us, but they are defeated. And so they go to the Lord. They cry out to the Lord. And it is discovered that they could not stand before their enemies, chapter 7, verse 12 says, because they become, Israel sinned, verse 11, and they have also transgressed my covenant, which I commanded them, for they've even taken some of the accursed things and have stolen and deceived, and they've also put it among their own stuff, and it, through a process, it comes, they come to find out that Achan is the one who took the stuff that he should not have taken, and Achan and his family, covenant head responsibility, Achan and his family are stoned, I believe it is, because of this incident. You have a similar thing happening with the Gibeonites. To me, this is an extremely interesting section. You go back to the regulations in Deuteronomy. If a nation is near and within the land of Canaan, you exterminate them. If they are far away, you can make a treaty with them. Now, it's interesting to me the Gibeonites understood that. I don't know how they understood that. But they make it look like they are from far away. Put on old clothes, disheveled, you know, shoes with holes in them. And they come and they request to make a treaty. And there is no consulting the Lord. In fact, the author of this section gives you a hint as to what's going on. It says in 9:1, it came to pass when all the kings who were on this side of the Jordan in the hills and in the lowland and in all the coasts of the great sea toward Lebanon, the Hittite, the Amorite, the Canaanite, the Perizzite, the Hivite, and the Jebusite heard about it, they gathered together to fight with Joshua and Israel with one accord. But the inhabitants of Gibeon heard what Joshua had done to Jericho, and so then they came up with this plan. Well, verse 7 says, the men of Israel said to the Hivites. The author is giving you a clue here You know, these were a part of the people of Canaan that should have been destroyed. And there's no consulting with Yahweh. And so they make this treaty with the Gibeonites. They rely on their own wisdom. And they don't consult the Lord. That's always a problem in this section when they are not relying on the guidance of the Lord. They get themselves into trouble. But when they trust in God, God fights for them, and they are victorious. Well, we've kind of looked at this section in a broad way. If you sort of go back and take it more in its chronological sense, you have taking of the central area, Jericho and Ai, and then they go up to Shechem near Mount Ebal, and there's a covenant ceremony. And then you have the southern campaign with the Gibeonites and the coalition and the Amorite kings. In fact, it's the Amorite kings who are attacking Gibeon, because they've made a treaty with Israel, and that's when Israel comes to the aid of the Gibeonites, and you have that battle described in chapter 10. And then they take further cities of the southern area so that the whole southern region is opened up to them. And then they turn their gaze up to the northern campaign, chapter 11, which includes the city of Hazor, which is probably the largest city in the north. And there are other people groups involved as you look at chapter 11. And God delivers this enemy into their hand as well. And so with the defeat of this enemy, the northern area virtually comes under the control of Israel as well. And so you have at the end of chapter 11, this statement: Joshua took the whole land, according to all that the Lord had said to Moses. And Joshua gave it as an inheritance to Israel, according to their divisions by their tribes. Then the land rested from war. And chapter 12 lists the kings conquered by Moses and Joshua. All right, inheritance of the land, chapters 13 through 22. These chapters describe the allotment of the land to the various tribes, including the cities of refuge and the towns for the Levites. The theme of this section: God's people received their inheritance as a result of the victory over their enemies. And, of course, that victory came because God fought for them. That's not a bad... You know, you can think in parallel terms: Christ, our divine warrior, fighting on behalf of us, winning our victory at the cross, the resurrection, and he will come back one day as the commander of the army of the Lord and will lead us into victory. So all these things have New Testament connotations related to Christ. But there's tension in this third section between the statements of 11:23, we've already read 11:23 right before break, and then a similar passage as 11:23 occurs in 21:43-45, which says this: The Lord gave to Israel all the land of which he had sworn to give to their fathers, and they took possession of it and dwelt in it. The Lord gave them rest all around, according to all that he had sworn to their fathers. Not a man of all their enemies stood against them. The Lord delivered all their enemies into their hand. Not a word failed of any good thing which the Lord had spoken to the house of Israel. All came to pass. These passages, 11:23 and this passage, are fairly comprehensive. God's promises were fulfilled. The land was taken. Yet you begin to read through chapters 13 and following that there's more work to be done. There's Canaanites still in the land. And so this has led to a question: was it a total conquest or a partial conquest? What are we to do with this tension? Well, let's ask two questions. Did Israel receive the land for her inheritance? Yes, the land is distributed among the tribes, right? The back of the enemy is broken. Israel received the land for her inheritance. Was there more work to be done? Yes. The job now of each of the tribes was to take the land that God had given to them, that had been allotted to them, and finish the job of driving out the Canaanites. And they had the promise that God would continue to fight for them. And so the back of the enemy was broken. That was the major conquest. And now the rest of the work needed to be completed by each of the tribes. And there are examples of great success in this regard. Caleb is an example in chapter 14 of great success. Now, Caleb is probably not on the young side, is he? He's getting up there in age. He was one of the original spies that went in. He was on that first generation. He and Joshua, in fact, in chapter 13, it mentions that Joshua was getting old, advanced in years, and the same is probably true for Caleb. And yet in chapter 14, Caleb defeats a formidable foe, the Anakim, who have the reputation of being a very great enemy. And he takes a mountain area. Verse 12. Back verse 11, you can kind of see Caleb's attitude. I am as strong this day as on the day that Moses sent me. Just as my strength was then, so now is my strength for war. So he may be getting on the old side, but he's still a man of valor. Now, therefore, give me this mountain of which the Lord spoke in that day, for you heard in that day how the Anakim were there, and the cities were great and fortified. It may be that the Lord will be with me, and that I shall be able to drive them out as the Lord has said. And that's what he does. An example of what the tribes, what all the tribes should do with the land that God has given to them. And yet, they don't. They don't complete the job of driving out the tribes. I'm sorry, of driving out the Canaanites. The tribes do not complete the job of driving out the Canaanites. Why not? Well, perhaps several reasons. Many of them may not have faith in God to fight for them. They have the promise of that in 13:6, and you've got the story of Caleb. And yet, 15:63 says, as for the Jebusites, the inhabitants of Jerusalem, the children of Judah could not drive them out, but the Jebusites dwell with the children of Judah at Jerusalem to this day. Some of the Israelites complain of the military might of the Canaanites. 17:16. The children of Joseph said, the mountain country is not enough for us, and all the Canaanites who dwell in the land of the valley have chariots of iron. So, what is the matter that they got chariots of iron? If Yahweh is fighting for you, but they don't finish the job because of the military power of the Canaanites. The same people of Joseph also complain that it's too difficult. Verse 15 of chapter 17. Joshua answered them, if you are a great people, then go up to the forest and clear a place for yourself. No, they don't want the mountain country. It's not enough. They want more. They want some of that flatter land. Some of the Israelites allow the people to live for their own comfort and welfare. Chapter 16, verse 10. They did not drive out the Canaanites who dwelt in Gezer, but the Canaanites dwell among the Ephraimites to this day and have become forced laborers. We'll make it easier for ourselves. We'll make them serve us and do some of those things that maybe we don't want to do. And so the inheritance was not fully taken because the people were not willing to battle the enemy and finish the job that was started. Basically, a lack of trust in God to fight for his people. Now, we haven't talked about, but you know the answer to the question. You know, the mission of Israel was to go into the land of Canaan and exterminate the Canaanites in fulfillment of God's promise to Abraham and also in judgment upon the Canaanites for their wickedness. Now, you know, there's several issues that we're not going to touch on in much depth. A lot of people have trouble with this command from God and sort of wrestle with how do you reconcile, you know, this God of the Old Testament who commands the extermination of the Canaanites with, you know, what you find in Jesus who says, love your enemies. Well, you know, a lot of that goes back to your view of who God is and his holy nature and the heinous of sin in his sight. And what happens in the land of Canaan is just really a precursor of what's going to happen on the day of judgment. And you do have to differentiate the mission of Israel and our mission today as God's people. And that's why we don't take up weapons. We've talked about this. You know, our warfare, their warfare was real military warfare with Yahweh fighting for them. Our warfare is a spiritual warfare, as Paul develops in the book of Ephesians, principalities and powers. But still, Yahweh fights for us. Christ has fought the main battle for us and won the victory. You know, he's won the victory. And now we await for that full victory. But in the meantime, we are to be engaging the enemy with spiritual battle. Preaching the Word of God, praying, witnessing to people, hoping people come to understand who Jesus Christ is. And then one day we will participate in another military victory, if you will. Much like perhaps what we saw in the book of Joshua, where our commander will lead us forth into the final battle and all forces of wickedness will be defeated. So, in just a nutshell, that's one response to that sticky question. If you are interested in pursuing this more, there is a book. It's one of these counterpoints books, Show Them No Mercy. Four Views on God and Canaanite Genocide. And the different positions here, I'll read the chapters. The Case for Radical Discontinuity. We probably wouldn't agree with that view. The Case for Moderate Discontinuity, that's argued by Eugene Merrill. The Case for Eschatological Continuity, and then the Case for Spiritual Continuity. And that fourth chapter is written by Tripper Longman. So if you're interested in pursuing that further, this is a fairly new book, the last year or two, 2003, that gets into some of those questions. And, you know, you might want to do a paper on this whole issue of being under the ban, like that would fit under a law thing. A law. You can find it in Deuteronomy and you can find it in Joshua as well. That brings us to the end of the book. Chapters 23 and 24. Another covenant renewal, which takes place at key points of history. The theme of this section, covenant blessings arise out of covenant commitment. And here Joshua encourages the people to continue following the Lord and not become tangled with the Canaanites. Disobedience to the covenant, 23:16, will bring loss of land. That's reinforced. Joshua rehearses God's goodness, and they swear the oath. They commit themselves to serve the Lord. In chapter 24:21, the people said to Joshua, "We will serve the Lord." And the fact that God's people basically served the Lord during Joshua's lifetime speaks well of his leadership. The book of Joshua concludes with the death of Joshua, and there is no transfer of leadership. And so the people are left in the land without a leader to guide them, and the book of Judges sort of picks up on that and describes what happens in that situation. Now, there's one more thing that I will comment on, and then we're basically finished. Let me come back very quickly. It won't take long at all. To this whole issue of land, rest, and inheritance. You've got these three concepts. Which in the Old Testament are connected. The land is to be a place of rest, as the promised land. It was to be a place of rest for them. It's called menucha, is a Hebrew term, place of rest. It's also their inheritance. And so these three ideas, and you can see how these three ideas are developed in the context of the Old Testament. But in the Old Testament, these three ideas are together. They're integral together. The land is to be a place of rest, and it is also their inheritance. It's what God has given Israel, and it fits their mission, and it sort of fits the fact that they are a theocracy. They're to live in the land and draw the nations to themselves. And if they are disobedient, the land no longer becomes a place of rest. And if they're disobedient, they lose their inheritance. Now, when you come to the New Testament, these three ideas are still significant, but they are not so closely connected together. When you think of the concept of rest in the New Testament, what do you think of? All right. Could be the Sabbath rest. Could be also Matthew 11. Jesus says, "Come to me, all you are weary and heavy laden, and I will give you rest." Yes, it's very much a now but not yet situation. But the rest that Jesus offers is not necessarily connected to a geographical place like it was in the Old Testament. What's the inheritance in the New Testament? We've already mentioned the passage, there's an inheritance reserved in heaven for you, where moth and rust will not corrupt. We have a down payment of our inheritance, Pentecost, the Spirit is poured out, but we haven't yet fully received that inheritance. Now but not yet situation. And what about land in the New Testament? Well, we've said already that the rest that Jesus offers is not connected to a specific geographic location. And that fits the whole idea that we've talked about here of us going out into all the world to take this message that Jesus brings life and rest to all the world. All three of these concepts will come back together when Jesus comes again. And ultimately, in the new heavens and new earth. We've already sort of made the connection between land, world, new heavens, and new earth. And I think you can see it again. In the new heavens and new earth, that is the ultimate fulfillment. We will receive our inheritance, which will not only be great spiritual blessings, but will include great physical blessings. Rest certainly includes that spiritual blessing, rest, contentment, but also not having to fear. You know, everybody being secure, living under their own vine. Not having to fear invading armies, which maybe for us is not as big a fear as it is in other places and as it was in the nation of Israel, have these Assyrian armies come through and just demolish everything. And so these Old Testament concepts, what we've seen all along, you have to sort of now understand them in light of the coming of Christ in this now but not yet situation. But then I encourage you to always push them to the final eschatological time period, you know, whatever your views on eschatology are. But certainly these point us to the new heavens and new earth. So just sort of rehashing some things that we've said sort of here and there along the way. You have any questions? Any questions about anything we've said or requirements? Or the Lord did not reveal to me that you don't have to do a paper, so that still stands. Yes, pardon?
Oh, that's what I had.
Well, never mind.
Thank you. Well,
the Lord still has to.
I didn't forget about the exam, but in terms of getting it to you. Yeah. It is the glory of kings to reveal a matter. yes, sir.
One of the virtual students asks the question, can we work together on the exam questions?
Yes, but not when they take the exam. But yes, they can work together on the exam questions. Well, this is what... my plan had been to maybe hand out the exam to you in a sealed envelope. Do we have here your home addresses? I assume we would if we've registered. Yes, sir.
Is the format going to be like you'll give us four questions, say choose three of the following four?
No, I don't think. It might be answered the following three questions. I don't recall if I give you a choice or not. But what I will do early next week is mail the exam to you. I'll probably put the exam in a sealed envelope and put that in a larger envelope with proctor instructions. And so if you get something next week in a larger envelope, you can open it up, and there will be the sealed envelope and the proctor instructions in there. And then you've got until the deadline date to take the exam, and there will be instructions on the proctor sheet. And, you know, you have to sign a pledge. You didn't receive any help beyond what the professor allowed, which isn't a whole lot. And... I don't believe you can use your Bibles for the exam. And the proctor will sign it, and then you can send it back. So why don't we do that? And if for some reason I have trouble getting most of you in here, I think I can track you down. I can track you down through the PCA thing if for some reason I can't find your address. So I think we'll be okay. I'll plan early next week to mail those to you. So you should get them midweek or later in the week. Yes?
Half an hour and come back. Will you be able to hours, because that would save you so much time.
Well, the problem is I've got some other things I need to do before I could get to that. So I appreciate that. I'll have Terry help me. So, but I appreciate that. Any other questions or comments? Why don't we close? I'll close this with a word of prayer. Father, we are grateful to you for the strength you've given to us this week. I'm thankful to you, Lord, for the attitude of these students, their love of you, and their desire to learn more about you. And Lord, we just pray that you would be with them as they go back to their homes and ministries, and that your blessing would be poured out abundantly upon them. And that we just pray that this time has been beneficial. We give you thanks for your love and just ask you to continue to use us for the benefit of your kingdom. We give you praise and thanks in Jesus' name.
The preceding program has been brought to you by RTS on iTunes U at the virtual campus of Reformed Theological Seminary and may not be reproduced or disseminated in part or in whole for sale or for profit without express written consent. For information on how you may obtain a fully accredited Master of Arts in Religion degree online, please visit us at virtual.rts.edu.